You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 328. And in this one, I got back on Dr. Russ Harris. Russ is a medical practitioner and author of the international best-selling self-help book, The Happiness Trap. Russ is also a world-renowned trainer of acceptance and commitment therapy, also known as ACT. So in this one, we talk about the new edition of his book, The Happiness Trap, and what's new about it, how ACT can help reduce rumination, Russ's view of rumination, noticing and interrupting rumination during an exposure. He discusses the exercise dropping anchor. He guides us through dropping anchor live on the podcast. We discuss learning to make space for uncomfortable thoughts and feelings. We talk about learning to urge surf, how to stop techniques becoming compulsions. Russ shares personal experience of himself putting some of this into practice, words of hope, and much more. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the episode description. And thank you, as always, to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Russ.
Welcome back to the show, Russ.
Thanks for having me back. Hard to believe it's been 4 years.
Yeah, it's a long time. Doesn't feel that way. So obviously, we talked a lot about the happiness trap the first time we chatted. You've recently done a rewrite of that, a second edition with 50% new material, I believe. So just initially, just anything you want to say about that?
Well, it wasn't supposed to be a 50% rewrite. You know, I thought I'll just, you know, because this is like 14 or 15 years since, when did the book came out in 2007? So almost 15. And I thought it would just be a little bit of tweaking and editing, you know. So I got a bit of a shock when I really got stuck into it. There was so much that was, in my opinion, a bit kind of waffly and out of date. And there was so much that I do with ACT these days that's not in the book. On the one hand, it was reassuring to see that I've changed a lot in how I do things over the years. But the downside was that it turned out to be a major ordeal in editing and rewriting. It's actually a significantly different book to the original. Probably 50% is probably an underestimate. But and then in the process of rewriting, there was also so much other stuff that I couldn't fit into the book. So there's kind of this extra ebook, The Happiness Trap, extra bits that goes with it, with lots of audio recordings and worksheets and bits and pieces that I didn't have room for in the main book. So. It was a labor of love and suffering.
Yeah, I bet it was. And I guess the question that comes to my mind is, lots of people loved the original, which is why it's now been rewritten. Otherwise, the publisher wouldn't commission that, right? So I guess the thought that came to my head, or maybe a worry, was, is it still the same book? You know, is it going to be, is it the same book we loved before?
Well, you know, it's the same book in that I'm the same author, but yeah. It's different in that I'm quite different in the way that I do ACT than I did, you know, 15 years ago. I realized, and I think I said to you that actually after our interview together back in 2018 alerted me to some things that I felt were underemphasized or missing from the first edition, you know, particularly how we deal with ruminating and worrying. You know, that kind of stuff is in there, but in this new second edition, there's a lot more emphasis on how we deal with those kind of really tricky mental processes that really pull us in and are kind of hard to get out of. And I guess, the ACT model in general over the last 15 years, we've seen a lot more emphasis on self-compassion. my favorite tool for ACT, which I think we touched on in the last interview, the choice point, a very useful little roadmap for applying ACT with ourselves, now has a much more central part in the book. It's the same book, but it's a different book. it's got the same overarching themes. It's based on ACT. It's got the same core elements, but it's also got a lot of new tools, techniques, strategies. Yeah. Parts of the model that weren't emphasized enough have got much more priority. So it's a significantly different reading experience. Mm. And it's also been really enjoyable recording it as an audio book.
You did the voiceover?
I did. Nice. I did, you know, I also did a few silly voices along the way, kind of at various points. Tried to inject a bit of humor into it, because there's nothing worse than listening to a really serious audiobook. Well, actually, there probably are things worse than that, but we won't talk about those here, because no. This is easy listening, right?
Yeah, true. I haven't read the whole book yet. I've read chapters of it, and I do like the real emphasis on exercises. It just feels very clearly laid out and very well argued on why this exercise should help. Let's talk about rumination then. Let's jump straight in. So I guess, what's ACT's view or your view of rumination, or how to stop rumination, or just generally, I guess, anything you want to share on that?
Well, yeah, I think, ACT, like many models, looks at rumination as a form of problem solving that's just gotten out of control. You know, we ruminate and ruminate and ruminate. And there are, it's normal, it's natural, and there are advantages to it. One thing is that if we ruminate enough, we do eventually, come up with some solutions or insights or understandings about whatever it is that we're struggling with. Another thing that many people don't realize is that actually, when we ruminate a lot, it pulls us into our heads. We get all caught up in our thoughts, and it actually helps us escape from painful feelings, unpleasant physical sensations. So it's not a consciously chosen strategy. People don't go, I'm going to ruminate to escape from unwanted feelings. But that's one of the things that happens in the short term that kind of feeds into rumination and keeps it going. Mm. Another thing is that it gives us a sense of that we're working hard on dealing with our problems and addressing our problems. So these things, technically, in technical terms, are called reinforcing consequences or reinforcers. They're kind of outcomes of rumination that lead to it maintaining or increasing over time. What triggers ruminating is difficult situations, difficult problems, and all the difficult thoughts and feelings that show up. So it's kind of a normal problem-solving process. How do I deal with this difficult stuff that just goes haywire and gets out of control, and then kind of has all these reinforcing consequences that make it more and more extensive? And it's very difficult to disrupt. ACT gives us some good technology for doing so.
Yeah, there is a really useful exercise, I think, that you put in the book in that chapter on, I think it's obsessing, worrying, and rumination. Maybe I've got the words in the wrong order, but the exercise is quite good in that. So, and I like what you said there about rumination is actually, if you're ruminating, you no longer have to sit with the guilt or the disgust or the anxiety in the case of OCD. Which again kind of links back to compulsions, right? We do them to avoid and get rid of those uncomfortable feelings, which I guess clashes with ACT, right? Because ACT's about accepting your experience or making space for it as opposed to avoiding it.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, the ACT approach would be, one is, how do we disrupt problematic behaviors? You can think of, often when we talk about behavior, we think in terms of what we do with our arms and legs, stuff that, kind of, we think of actions, but behavior also includes what goes on inside our heads. And we can think of worrying, obsessing, ruminating as they're forms of internal behavior, often called private behavior. We can interrupt those processes because they are not usually, you know, I kind of, a metaphor or analogy I use quite often is the idea of a rickety bicycle. You know, if you want to get from, say, London to Edinburgh, you can get there on a rickety old bicycle, but it'll take you a long, long time to get there. And you'll be in a lot of pain and you won't be in very good condition by the time you get there. If what you want to do is get from London to Edinburgh, there's lots of other ways. You can have a really good bicycle or a car or a bus or a train or an aeroplane. You know, it'll get you there much faster in much better condition. And, you know, what ACT offers is much better ways of addressing those problems, coming up with action plans, developing the insights into why this is happening or what you do about it or how to prevent this from happening in future. We can learn those kind of new skills very effectively, and they can become new alternatives to ruminating and worrying and obsessing. But it's not enough to learn those new skills. You also need to be able to kind of deal with all the difficult thoughts and feelings that trigger these cognitive processes. The term I use a lot in the book is the idea of unhooking from difficult thoughts and feelings. So we kind of tackle this from different angles. One is kind of understanding what triggers and reinforces it. Another is what are alternative things we can do instead that are more effective. And a third is kind of learning a whole range of unhooking skills to unhook from all those difficult thoughts and feelings. A fourth piece of this is, of course, the kind of traditional mindfulness stuff about refocusing your attention on what you're doing right here, right now, and engaging in that fully, which is, you know, the complete opposite of what's going on when we're ruminating, worrying, and obsessing, and we're just totally lost in those thoughts.
Yeah, good answer. I guess what comes to my mind on rumination is, so if we think about when a listener is going through an exposure with their therapist or any therapist listening doing the exposure, we can obviously, and me speaking as a therapist, I can see when my client's physically doing compulsions during an exposure, which obviously we don't want to happen. I can't necessarily see inside their head. I can see if their eyes glaze over and I can ask them, are you ruminating? Are you doing X, Y, Z? How would you, let's say you were doing an exposure with someone with OCD, I guess even like a trauma exposure. I don't want to say keep them out of their head, but keep them out of ruminating.
Yeah, well, one of the most useful scales that I use is just 0 to 10. How present are you right now? You know, 10 is I'm fully present right here with you, focused on you, engaged in what we're doing. 0 is I've checked out of the room completely. I'm somewhere else altogether. You know, in a trauma situation, that might be a completely dissociative state. But, you know, with OCD, I'm just completely lost in my thoughts. I'm not really here at all. Most people are actually pretty good at answering that question. They're able to tell you when they're a 10 or when they're a 5 or when they're a 2, you know, in fact, just stopping to check and see how present I am usually will actually start to make you just a little bit more present. I found this to be particularly useful if you're, like telehealth has really taken off in the wake of COVID. And so if therapists are working with clients over Zoom or in some cases over the telephone, this simple 0 to 10 check-in is a very effective method for kind of helping clients and helping you to gauge what's going on for them. It's not foolproof, but it's a nice addition to those verbal signs of glazing eyes and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, I like that. Thank you. Sorry, were you going to add something there?
Yeah, well, it was kind of, you mentioned trauma and the So I have another book out at the moment, which is a textbook, Trauma Focused Act. And of course, there's quite often a big overlap between trauma and OCD. And, you know, many people with OCD have had traumatic events in their background that have played a role in this. And one of the other scales that I've recommended to use there is 0 to 10, you know, how much in control of your physical actions are you? As 10 is, I can move my arms and legs freely. I can move my mouth and face freely. I have a lot of control over my physical actions. Whereas 0 is I've completely frozen up. I'm locked up. You know, in trauma, we kind of talk about this as a freeze state. I mean, you've kind of gone into this frozen state where you can't move at all. And to a lesser degree, we all kind of experience this. The more we kind of get hooked by our thoughts and feelings, the more inflexible and rigid we become with our physical actions. And so actually, it just kind of starting to take control of your physical actions, moving, stretching, and seeing that you have actually got good control over your arms and your legs is a way of becoming more mindful, a way of becoming more present. So 10 is I've got full freedom to move my arms, my legs, my mouth, control of my physical actions. 0 is I've got no control at all. I'm just, you know, completely frozen up, locked up. And of course, this is useful with OCD because, you know, when you're doing your compulsions, you don't have that degree of control over your physical actions. So starting to see that you can actually stretch and move and change your position and wiggle your fingers starts to give you a sense of actually there are some things here I can exert control over, even with these difficult feelings present.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, and especially when anxiety is quite intense. At least for me, sometimes it's felt like I feel like I can't even get off the bed or the chair, like I can't move, you know. It's like a feeling of weakness, I guess. So yeah, that would be useful there too.
You know, it's that sense of just being flattened or steamrolled or just, you know, the life's just drained out of you, you've got no energy. And very often just starting to simply kind of, okay, so here I am. I'm flattened by this anxiety. I can't move. Now, let's start to see what I can move. Let's try wiggling my fingers here. Let's try wiggling my toes. Let's try nodding my head. Oh, I've got a little bit of movement here. What else can I move? What else can I move? You know, and actually just start coming back into your body and then starting to tune in mindfully to those physical movements. And you can do this in... if you know things like yoga and Tai Chi, then it's great. You've got those lovely mindful movements, but you don't have to learn yoga and Tai Chi to do this. We can all kind of stretch and move. And that's another way of starting to get present.
Yeah. Good points. And I tried learning Tai Chi a few years ago. I just didn't have the patience. I think it's awesome, and I'd love to one day master it. But the progress was way too slow for me. So on that, you've kind of started to allude to it, and it's something I use with a lot of my clients. So I wondered if you could one kind of just share and demonstrate or talk about what dropping anchor is. And then also maybe just, if okay with you, run us through a quick version of it.
Yeah, okay. Well, so dropping anchor is an umbrella term for dozens, if not hundreds, of different mindfulness exercises that are all based on a simple three-part formula. And I would say that this is probably the easiest mindfulness exercise for anybody to do, anybody to learn, anybody to apply. I'm not sure if I mentioned last time that I'd been working with the World Health Organization, they kind of highlighted my career, actually. They invited me to write a protocol based on acceptance and commitment therapy for use in refugee camps around the world. And that was back in 2015, and they've been rolling this protocol out, and it's a group protocol. It's a series of 2-hour workshops, which is totally delivered by audio recordings. So they'll get these are done in refugee camps in Syria, Uganda, Turkey, and so forth, and they'll get 20 to 30 refugees in a room. They'll have a few little cartoon pictures to look at to illustrate key concepts. And they'll listen to these audio recordings that take them through the ACT model and teach them the basic skills. And about half an hour into the first group session, we teach them dropping anchor. And this is important because this is a very safe exercise for people who suffer from trauma. There's a lot of mindfulness practices that are potentially dangerous for people with acute trauma. You know, if you sit still with your eyes closed, focusing on your thoughts and feelings, that can actually trigger flashbacks and trigger unpleasant emotional reactions and cognitive fusion and so forth. So, we needed to make sure that this kind of practice, given that most people in refugee camps have had multiple traumas, and certainly in the studies the World Health Organization were doing, almost everybody had significant PTSD and depression. So we needed to make sure it was safe for people with trauma. The other thing the World Health Organization insisted on was that it didn't resemble meditation, because to many cultures, meditation, it seems like a religious practice. Sometimes it's misinterpreted as coming from other religions, or it's a form of prayer. And so the nice thing about dropping anchor is it does not resemble meditation in any way. So it's a simple to learn, it's safe, it's not some of your listeners have probably tried meditation and found it difficult or boring or tedious. I know that's a common response. I don't know if you've had that one yourself.
I've heard that many times. I mean, some people say it's been great, and other people will say it's set them back. You know, quite extreme responses.
Exactly. So you get a whole range of experiences. I'll explain what's involved. The cool thing about this, so the World Health Organization have now published three studies on this protocol in kind of top scientific journals. And it's very cool. It's been shown to significantly reduce PTSD and depression. But the most recent one that came out showed that it actually prevented the onset prevented the onset of mental illness in a significant percentage of refugees with the high levels of stress. So it's not just a cure, but a prevention. So it's pretty cool stuff. And it's kind of almost got the whole ACT model built into this one little exercise. I think I might have oversold it here.
No, it's good.
Dropping anchor, basically the metaphor is, you know, that when your ship's sailing into harbour, your boat's sailing into harbour, if a big storm blows up, the first thing you need to do is drop anchor. Otherwise, the storm's going to sweep your boat out to sea. It's the same thing with our emotional storms. We kind of want to learn, you know, all those difficult thoughts, feelings, emotions blow up inside us, and they easily sweep us away, sweep us off track. And so we kind of learn how to drop anchor so that we can stay steady and take effective action. When a boat drops anchor, that doesn't control the storm. It doesn't make the storm go away. The storm will come and stay and go in its own good time as it pleases. But what dropping anchor does do is hold the boat steady. Not completely steady. And so when we drop anchor, it's the same thing. It's to kind of hold us steady so that we can take effective action, do what's going to work best for us while this emotional storm is raging inside us. So it's not a way to control those emotions, but it's a way to control our physical actions and what we do when this difficult stuff is showing up inside us. And the three-step formula can be remembered with the acronym ACE. So the A is acknowledge your inner world, or acknowledge your thoughts and feelings. The C is for connect with your body, or come back into your body if you prefer. And the E is for engage in your activity, or engage in what you're doing, or engage in the world. Basically bringing your attention back to what you're doing right here, right now, focusing on it. And dropping anchor exercises, you typically cycle through the ACE three or four times and you know, while you're learning and practicing this skill. And with lots of practice, you get to a point where you can just do it almost instantly, just almost in a second or two, just acknowledge your feelings, come back into your body and engage in what you're doing. But while you're developing the skill, you want to do longer practices to really kind of work with it.
Yeah, I like that. And the last bit, you did allude to it. You can also use your senses, right? Your five senses to re-engage with the world that way. And then
So typically the E involves engaging with the world through your five senses. What do I see, hear, touch, taste, and smell? And then focusing your attention on the actual activity that you're doing. You know, it would depend on the situation that you're in. If you're in a business meeting, you know, and you're feeling really stressed, then you just kind of, you get to a point where you can literally do this in a couple of seconds. You just acknowledge that you're anxious. You come back into your body in some way, take a breath or straighten your spine, and then engage your attention on the actual business meeting itself. So if we're going to do this now, I'd probably want to do a longer version, a 3 or 4 minute version, to give people a sense of what's involved.
Yeah, if you're happy to do that.
Yeah, and then I can give you some links to some free audio recordings if people want to take this away and practice it.
Yeah, I know where that link is. I'll add it to the show notes. Got, on there, you've, like you said, you've got the 30-second drop and anchor audio. You've got like 2 minutes on it. You think you've got like a 7 minute and maybe even longer than that.
Yeah, exactly. Lovely. All right. So we'll do this now. You'll be my guinea pig.
I can do it. Yeah.
Okay. So the A is for acknowledge your inner world, acknowledge your thoughts and feelings. So if you and your listeners just want to take a moment to just kind of notice what thoughts are popping up right now, what your mind's doing. Is your mind chattering away or is it relatively quiet? Just kind of notice what's going on. And also notice what feelings are showing up in your body. What can you notice in your chest and your shoulders and your abdomen? What can you notice in your face and your forehead? What can you notice in your arms and your legs? So just kind of acknowledge whatever thoughts and feelings are there. Not trying to control them or change them in any way, just kind of noticing they're there and acknowledging they're there. And that's the A. And then the C is to come back into your body or connect with your body in some way. So I'm going to push my feet into the floor and encourage your listeners to try this, pushing your feet into the floor and straightening your back and having a stretch, having a good stretch. So kind of noticing that, you know, you can move this body in a number of different ways. You've got a lot of control over your actions right now and really feeling that movement and that stretching. There's a body around your thoughts and feelings, a body that you can really control to a large degree in terms of what you do with it. And around this body, there's a room. So if they're not already, opening your eyes and opening your ears and looking around the room and breathing in the air and noticing what you can see and hear and touch and smell and just kind of getting a sense of the room around you. And then focusing your attention on the activity you're doing right now, which is tuning into this podcast and hopefully giving it your full attention. And so those are the three basic steps. And is it okay if we zip through this a couple of times? I'll just talk a bit less and put a bit more quiet in. Is that okay?
Yep.
So once again, taking a moment to acknowledge your thoughts and feelings and see if you can silently put that into words, what you're noticing there. So I am noticing thoughts about, or I'm noticing my mind chatting about. I'm noticing feelings of. I'm noticing a feeling of X, Y, and Z. Just see if you can put into words what you're actually noticing showing up inside you. I'm noticing anxiety. I'm noticing worrying. And just not trying to change it, just acknowledging it's there in this moment. And at the same time, coming into your body, connecting with your body. So once again, I'm pushing my feet down, straightening my back. And again, having a stretch in some way, I'm stretching my arms out, but you might want to shrug your shoulders or roll your neck around or any kind of shift in position, any kind of movement or stretching is fine. Something that connects you with your body and feel that body moving, feel it stretching. So there's thoughts and feelings and a body around them. And then once again, engaging with the world around you, opening your eyes and ears, noticing what you can see and hear, breathing in the air. So there's thoughts and feelings, a body around them, and a world around your body that you can engage with and interact with. And can we do that one more time? Is that okay? Yeah. So once again, acknowledging your thoughts and feelings, silently putting those into words. I'm noticing. Here is a feeling of. I'm noticing thoughts about. I'm having a feeling of. So just acknowledging those thoughts and feelings are here in this moment. Not trying to get rid of them or control them, just acknowledging. Here they are, same way you would acknowledge a visitor on your doorstep. And again, finding your own way of connecting with your body, straightening, stretching, moving, breathing, whatever helps you connect with this physical body, noticing how you can move it. Now you have a lot of control over your physical actions. So much stuff you can do. Check it out. Experiment. And around that body, there's a whole world. So once again, engaging for your eyes and ears. What can you see and hear? Breathing in the air. So there's thoughts and feelings here. A body here you can move. A world around that you can engage in. And you and me here doing this weird practice and giving your full attention to this podcast right now. And so that's the basic gist of it. And what was that like for you?
Yeah, it was good. Like I did it this morning, actually. I had lots of thoughts and feelings that were uncomfortable. And I was kind of getting carried away in my head. So while my car was parked, I quickly did a very quick version of dropping anchor. And like you said, it just helps remind you. But in this instance, yeah, that again, those similar thoughts and feelings. Well, firstly, it was, I'm doing Drop an Anchor with Russ Harris was the first thoughts that were coming to my head. And then I started again, those more troubling thoughts and feelings were coming up for me. But by the third round, I was much more calm, both in feeling and thought. Yeah. I know that's not the goal of it, but that's what happened for me.
Yeah, that's right. It's like that's not the goal, but that is the common experience, you know. And of course, that's the danger that goes with it is that it's like, oh, now I've found a way to control my emotional storms. So then people start dropping anchor expecting that. And of course, it doesn't always, although it does often, it doesn't always go that way. Sometimes a storm will rage and get worse before it eventually passes. But you can see that that's really quite an easy technique to learn and so different to meditating, right?
Yeah, I like it. And sometimes, yeah, I think dropping anchor, but I skip or leave the A and the E and I just do the C. I just quickly notice what my feet are like on the floor. Like if I've literally got a second, and sometimes that's enough just to think, okay, it's still there, but I'm going to choose to do this thing.
Yeah. And that's the idea, to get to that point where you can really do that. If you've got the luxury of doing longer ones as a more kind of formal mindfulness practice, that's great. But the nice thing about this is that you can practice it no matter what your emotional weather. You don't have to wait till a storm blows up. You can do this when you've got a little bit of frustration at red traffic lights or while you're waiting in a queue at the supermarket. Or you can even do it when the weather is great. I mean, you can do this as a kind of way to just appreciate, you know, one of those lovely moments when life's giving you what you want. And all of those little moments of practice throughout the day build up your psychological muscles to deal with the big emotional storms. Yeah. The other thing that's great about it is that you adjust it for anyone. Like if you've got someone with chronic pain syndrome that, you know, that would hurt them to push their feet into the floor, then maybe an alternative would be just to ever so slowly adjust your position in the chair to a slightly more comfortable position and really notice which muscles you use to do that. You know, you probably noticed I didn't really emphasize breathing there. And again, that's because some people, when they focus on their breath, actually find it increases their anxiety or it makes them lightheaded and dizzy. So I know a lot of mindfulness practices do focus on that breath, but it's important to recognize that that's not appropriate for everyone. Yeah. So, you know, if people listening to this find that breathing is a practice, you know, kind of that slow breathing, that slow mindful breathing that helps them connect with their body and that works for them, that's great. But for people listening that find the opposite, you don't have to focus on the breath. Anything that really just helps you connect with your body is fine.
Yeah, good point. And yeah, I've had clients that I've tried to do breath work and they're just like, hell no, you know, they don't want to do it, or they've tried it and they've felt dizzy. And I've rarely had pushback with dropping anchor. Rarely anyone's had an issue.
Yeah. I mean, sooner or later, you know, there's nothing that's going to work for everyone. But one of the things that I was really excited about with that first big study from the World Health Organization was, for using this with PTSD, there was not one single reported adverse incident, you know, which is quite amazing when working with trauma. So it's a very, very safe practice.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. Well, thank you for guiding us through that. So the next question is around, especially with OCD, that the thoughts can be very scary, where they're ego dystonic. We don't want them. And sometimes trying to accept or make space for the presence of them, not the content, I want to reassure people, but the presence that I'm having a thought. How would you work with that resistance of, I don't want to make space or accept these thoughts, you know?
Yeah, well, I would begin by kind of recognizing that's completely normal and natural. I mean, who wants to have scary, difficult thoughts and all the unpleasant feelings that go with them? You know, certainly not me. I don't really, I guess if you're some sort of masochist, you might like that or something, but I don't think most people would. So yeah, it's completely natural, normal reaction. And one of the things with acceptance and commitment therapy is we would never, ever ask anybody to open up and make room and allow difficult thoughts and feelings to be there unless it was in the service of something really important, something that really matters. So, you know, the question is, what matters enough? What's important enough that you'd be willing to do this scary, difficult work? And this is one of the things I think that is a little bit different in emphasis in exposure at the core of the ACT model, is this emphasis on values and values-based goals. We're not doing this exposure work to, you know, control our anxiety or to control our feelings. We're doing it so that we can live our values, pursue meaningful goals, get out there, build the life that we want, do the things that really matter. And so the question is, are you willing to make room for these difficult thoughts and feelings and do these new skills and learn how to let this stuff be there so that you can get out there and live your life and do what's important? And so certainly in ACT approaches, there would be a lot of that sort of work initially. You know, if our therapy is successful, what are you going to be doing differently with your life? You know, what's going to be different in your relationships? What are you going to stop doing and start doing? What are you going to do more of or less of? What are other people going to notice that's different about you if our work here is successful? Now, if that's what you want your life to be about, are you willing to do this kind of really difficult stuff? And the other piece of it is breaking it down, baby steps. You know, it's Stuart, how do you eat an elephant?
Piece at a time.
Exactly, exactly. And if you're a vegetarian, then the same applies for a tofu elephant. So it's one piece at a time. And so it's like, okay, let's not pick the most difficult, scary, difficult, awful four to ever. Let's kind of pick one that's not so scary, and let's kind of do a bit of work with that, and then build up your psychological muscles over time.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, good answer. So urge surfing. So obviously with compulsions, you know, you get the urge to do a compulsion to try and get rid of the thought, the feeling, which is why we do compulsions. Obviously, if we can surf that urge, ride that urge out, then we may find, actually, I don't feel I need to do the compulsion as much anymore. In the book, you use TAME acronym. I just wondered if you could talk maybe a little about urge surfing and the TAME acronym.
Yeah. So the, you know, kind of urge surfing was a term that I believe was originally coined by Marlett and Gordon, psychologists in the 1970s, who kind of took a Zen approach in their relapse prevention programs. And the term has stuck. And I think it's a really cool term, actually, urge surfing. The idea is that urges are a lot like waves. They rise and they reach a peak and then they fall again, and then they rise and reach a peak and then they fall again. And if we can learn how to surf those waves rather than resisting them. If you try to resist a wave, you get slammed by it or smashed by it or dunked by it. But if you surf a wave, then it's a very different experience. So again, not a way to control our urges, and we're certainly not resisting our urges. We're surfing our urges. We're kind of mindfully noticing how they rise and reach a peak and then they fall again. And a lot of people have never really experienced that, because as soon as their urge gets too high, they just give in and do what the urge tells them to do. Or they resist it in some way, so they never get to, you know, whether that's through distraction or drugs or alcohol or whatever, so they never get to kind of mindfully, consciously experience that an urge will rise and reach a peak and then fall. So the TAME acronym is really, I mean, it's an acronym that really applies to any difficult inner experience. It applies with emotions and urges and cravings and impulses. So the acronym is take note, allow, make room, and expand awareness. So it actually overlaps a lot with the dropping anchor. So the take note part is really just kind of that mindful noticing and naming of the urge itself. And the allow is that we basically go a step further than acknowledging. It's like, this stuff is here, this urge is here, it's painful, it's unpleasant, I don't want it, but I'm going to allow it. I'm just going to let it be here, even though I don't want it. The M, making room, is really a kind of variety of ways of just opening up and making space and allowing the urge to be there with all the physical sensations that go with it, and all the thoughts and images that might show up along with that too, about, you know, what the urge involves and what I want to do. So there's kind of this physical component, these physical sensations in the body, but usually there's also this cognitive element too, you know, what your mind's telling you that you need to do or have to do. So we kind of repeatedly take note, we allow this stuff to be there, even though we don't like it, we open up and make room for it. We can track the urge if we want to on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 is at its peak. We can say, oh, it's a 3, now it's a 5, now it's a 7, now it's 10, and now it's a 9, and now it's an 8, and now it's a 7, and we can kind of watch it rising and falling. And we... you know, the E then is to expand awareness, which is a bit like the E at the end of dropping anchor. So there's an urge here, all the feelings and thoughts that go with that urge. and there's a body here that I can move, and there's a world here that I can engage in. And so there's a lot more here than just this urge. You know, very often the urge just becomes the center of our universe, and it's all about this urge. And so we're not doing distraction here. Distraction is the opposite of mindfulness. We're doing a kind of expansive awareness. There's an urge here, and a body here, and a world here. There's a lot of stuff here in addition to this urge. And what am I going to do now that's more life-enhancing than struggling with this urge, battling with it? What am I going to put my energy into? What am I going to put my attention into? And this is very liberating for people. People do realize, you know, the urges do have this kind of cycle of rising and falling. But even just stopping to notice and name the urge and acknowledge that it's there takes some of its power away. When we're on automatic pilot, when we're not really consciously aware of these urges, they jerk us around like a puppet on a string. So just that conscious noticing and naming of it starts to activate different parts of the brain, different parts of the nervous system, that starts to give us more control over our actions with the urge present.
Yeah, I like that. Thank you. Another one is sometimes, like, if I get an itch, I'll do my best not to itch it, and just use that as a way of teaching myself to see that that urge will drop. You know, there's a point where you feel like you're going to go crazy because you have to itch it, and if you just hold on, it does go down. At least in my experience.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas most of us have also had that other where we've scratched the itch, and then a few seconds later, it's even more itchy than before.
Exactly.
A nice analogy.
So with diffusion options for OCD, or just any kind of ACT exercises like dropping anchor, notice and naming, how do we stop those from becoming compulsions? So I've noticed sometimes with clients I've had, or even I guess in my own experience, use certain tools as a way of, like, or it becomes a compulsion to lower that anxiety, lower that guilt or feeling I'm not doing it anymore for the sole purpose of what it was intended for. I'm now doing it as a kind of a compulsion.
Yeah, well, if you find a simple answer to that one, please let me know. That is a real challenge. I mean, a big part of the answer is self-awareness, and just being open and honest with yourself and starting to check in, you know, what's my motivation here? I think we're pretty good at telling when we're turning things into compulsions. One of the telltale signs is a loss of vitality. It's like there's a rigidity to it. There's a pressure to it. There's a sense of still being trapped and having to conform and having to do something, a loss of agency. I think really one of the things that's often good is just to do little check-ins throughout the day and see, you know, how am I going here? Am I really applying ACT principles here? Am I being present, opening up, doing what matters? Or am I doing something that's different, that's taking me back into my obsessions and compulsions? I think that sense of vitality and freedom is a good indicator. If I have a sense of freedom, freedom of choice, freedom of what I'm doing, and a sense of vitality and embracing life in what I'm doing, that indicates that I'm on the right track. But if I have a sense of the opposite, you know, that's kind of rigidity and trapped, and I have to do this and pressure, and there's not really any life in it, that's a good indicator to me that I'm turning this into a compulsion. So it's kind of checking in, awareness, being honest with yourself. No magic answer, but
I think that's a good answer.
Oh, okay.
That's fine. So more of a personal question now, if I'm okay to answer it. When was a time recently when you had to apply ACT skills and unhook yourself?
Oh, all the time at the moment. My my son is 16 and he's going through his, I'm not sure, I think he's just watched a bunch of TikTok videos about how to be a difficult teenager, and he's just kind of it's so cliche at times, it's like but boy, he's pushing my buttons a lot. He, you know, the other thing that's kind of made it challenging is for a long time, my ex-wife and myself, we kind of shared him 50-50, but now he's living with me 100% of the time. So it's kind of, it's a double challenge, you know. I don't get that relief every 2 weeks where I palm him off to his mum. Gosh, I hope he never listens to this. So, yeah, he's being a very challenging teenager. He would say I'm being a very challenging father, I'm sure. You know, and a lot of times I have to kind of, I really drop anchor a lot to so that I don't kind of blow my top and, you know, lots of anger and frustration showing up for me. Why do you have to be so difficult? Can't you read some of the books that I've written? But my books are apparently for boring old boomers. So there you go.
Fair enough. Well, yeah.
That's the dark side. Yeah, he's a lovely kid. He's a wonderful kid. But, you know, like all relationships, there are difficulties. Yeah. And like all teenagers, he's got his troublesome side.
Well, that's it. Part of being a teenager is pushing boundaries and limits. And yeah, so but you're handling it well, it sounds like, or the best you can.
Well, most of the time, not all the time. Yeah. Gosh. It's I remember actually this was last year. I completely, I can't even remember what it was, but I had a meltdown and I kind of I was yelling and shouting and lost my temper completely. And of course, when I calmed down, I was so mortified. And I went out and I said, look, I'm really sorry about this, you know. And gosh, you know, I write all these books and how to deal with difficult emotions, and look at what happened to me there. I got completely hooked and jerked around by my feelings, and you know, that's not the sort of dad I want to be. And you know, God, and I said, can you imagine if all the people that read my books, you know, imagine if they kind of knew about that? And he said, I'm gonna tell them, you know. Like, well, all right, I better tell them first before you do. So but you know, I mean, that's another part of ACT, as we were saying at the start, is self-compassion. Yeah. You know, life is difficult. We're all imperfect. No matter how good we get at using these skills, there's going to be times we forget them, or our thoughts and feelings get the better of us. We will all act in self-defeating ways. We'll move away from our values. We'll do things that are so far removed from the sort of person we really want to be, and we're going to hurt and suffer at those times. So we really want to develop that capacity for self-compassion, and instead of just beating ourselves up, which just makes us everything worse, can we acknowledge our pain and our hurt and be there in a kind and caring and supportive way for ourselves. And that's a big challenge for people too. You know, there's a lot of people find self-compassion is even harder than mindfulness. So again, that often requires baby steps.
Yeah, true. Yeah, we're all human, right? And we're going to make mistakes. It's just part of existence. But yeah, no, thank you for your vulnerability, for sharing that. So I guess lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have said or shared today?
No, I think I thanks for having me back on the show. It's good. It was like, you know, I guess I hadn't realized it was, again, our last interview in 2018 kind of opened my eyes to the fact that a lot of folks with OCD were actually reading this book. You know, it's so I really wanted to make sure that it was much better suited to people that are struggling with those issues. And so I'm grateful to you for that interview and that insight.
I appreciate it.
will find it. You know, again, the dropping Ganka exercise, if you read the book, you'll see there's so many ways you can use it to interrupt compulsions and to kind of work with the obsession is a kind of emotional storm in and of itself. And, you know, using dropping Ganka to interrupt ruminating and worrying, there's a lot of applications of it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, well, thank you for including people with OCD, you know, or thinking more about them. I'm sure I appreciate it, and I'm sure others do too. But as always, look, it's always great to speak with you, and anytime you want to come back on, just let me know.
Lovely. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.